Les colloques du Collège de France.
First of all, me too, I want to thank the organizers for this wonderful conference and for the invitation. I will talk about fragmentation of family property. Individually owned property existed in Mesopotamia from the earliest historic times. The evidence from the third millennium is sparse, but from the beginning of the second millennium, plenty of evidence becomes available. Many documents on sale, exchange, pledge, loan, lease, and rent show that not only representatives of institutions had property at their disposal, but also persons who acted privately on their own behalf. These persons were mostly the heads of their families, men who lived in a household together with a wife and their children, as well as their slaves. The household was called in Sumerian E'ada, in Akkadian Beit Abim, the house of the father. This term referred also to the assets of a family household. When I use the term family property, I mean the assets of a Beit Abim, consisting of house plots, gardens, fields, slaves, livestock, and chattels, which were at the command of the pater familias. While institutions can exist over long time spans, individuals have a shorter expectation of life. Therefore, wherever property is individually owned, the question arises as to what to do when the head of the family dies. It is reasonable to pass the property on to the younger generation. If there are many children in a family, however, and every child gets a share, the property will be divided into many small pieces and dispersed. The fragmentation of property caused by inheritance division was, and remains even today, a danger to individually owned assets. In different times and places, strategies were developed to counteract this effect. One example was the principle of primogeniture, which applied particularly to succession to the throne within ruling dynasties. Only the firstborn son was considered as heir, but not his siblings. Thus, any division was avoided. The Roman law provided the possibility of entailment. The testator converted part of his property into a sort of foundation, which could not be divided, sold, or mortgaged. One member of the family got the right of usufruct, but the whole family remained the owner of the entailment. Even today, in some parts of Germany, a special law remains in force relating to the inheritance of farms and forest land. Only one of the heirs gets the assets and compensates his co-heirs on favorable terms. And I would like to know what mechanisms are there in France or on other parts of the world. But what was the legal situation in ancient Babylonia? Information is provided by nearly 300 old Babylonian inheritance documents. The geographical distribution is shown on the map. These documents were drawn up after the heirs had divided the estate of a deceased. They served as title deeds for the heirs, confirming their ownership of the inherited items and especially of real estate. In contrast to Assyria, there is not a single will attested in Babylonia. The succession was intestate. Legal collections, like the Codex Hammurabi, add provisions for special cases, but take the general rules of inheritance division as given. These belong to the sphere of common law and legal custom. From the old Babylonian inheritance documents, it becomes evident that property was passed on to the next generation via the male line, patrilineally, from the father to his sons. daughters got a dowry consisting mostly of movables when they got married. They left their family, moved into the household of their father-in-law or husband, and had no further rights to the property of the family from which they had originated. Because the dowry consisted mostly of movables and what administered by their husbands, married women very rarely occur in the documents. Family in the old Babylonian period thus appears to us in the majority of cases as a group of male relatives, descendants of one father, though there were also women who had real estate at their disposal, as we will discuss later. By excluding daughters as heirs, the number of inheritance shares was reduced. However, this alone could not prevent the family property from being split up in shares so small that they were economically insignificant. Let's have a look at an example. Towards the end of the 19th century, in the 13th regnal year of Damik Elishu, four brothers got together in the city of Nippur. Their father had died. His inheritance comprised a field of 4 hectares, a house plot of 32 square meters, and some furniture. At first, the eldest son of the four sons got an extra share. Usually in Nippur, that comprised 10% of the whole inheritance. In our example, the eldest son got only an extra share in the field, that means 0.4 hectare, but apparently no extra share in the house. The remaining property was divided among the four heirs in equal parts. Each one got 0.9 hectare of the field and nearly 8 square meters of the house. The calculation is easy and demonstrates clearly the problem. What could an heir do with such a small plot? 8 square meters is only a small room, and it must have also been extremely difficult to reasonably divide a house into 4 shares of precisely 8 square meters. The share in the field was small too. From a 0.9 hectare field, a harvest of 360 liters of barley could be expected on average per year. The heir alone could only live on that amount for half a year, and this does not take account of his family he may have had. It cannot be ruled out that the inheritance actually contained more assets, was divided in several stages, and we see only a part of it through the prevented inheritance document. However, this is not the only document concerned with rather small shares. The mode of inheritance division among all the sons could only lead to fragmentation of family property into smaller and smaller shares over time. What did the Babylonians do to counteract this development? To answer this question, I will present 4 strategies attested in the documents for keeping family property together and discuss how often these strategies were actually applied. My paper will concentrate on the textual material from Nippur because it contains good examples, especially following publication of the old Babylonian documents from the Hilprecht collection in TMH 10 by Anne Roderes. The simple strategy against the destructive consequences of inheritance division was not to divide the property of a deceased at all. The heirs took over the property in joint heirship. They administered the property together and shared only the profits. This strategy seems to suggest itself, but it is difficult to find evidence for it because when a person died and his inheritance devolved to his heirs undivided, there was no need for documentation. There is some indirect evidence at least. For example, in the family of Ninesigu in Nippur. Anaxagoras has published the huge family tree. If we add the inheritance divisions, we see that in the first two generations, two divisions are attested respectively. Obviously, the inheritance of Ninlilzingu and his eldest son were not divided completely at once, but part of it was owned jointly for a short period of time. The dossier of the Ninlilzingu family provides another example where joint heirship lasted even over several generations. According to the inheritance document TMH 1019, an unbuilt plot of the remarkable size of 720 square meters was divided by four parties in 1745. The inheriting parties were the heirs of the four sons of Ninlilzingu's second eldest son, Imshishi. The plot was surrounded by three streets by the names of Street Behind the Temple of the Goddess Ama Arasu, Street of Mr. Libur, and Wall Street. The exact date of Imshishi's death is unknown. Between 1867 and approximately 1857, he is attested alive as neighbor and witness. The division of the plot took place more than 100 years later, in 1754. During this period, it was owned jointly by the descendants of Imshishi. Another document bears the same date and was probably written right before the inheritance division. It gives us more information on this joint heirship. In the first part of the document, the same unbuilt plot is described. By means of old title deeds, it is confirmed that the plot indeed belonged to Imshishi, who had acquired 1/3 by inheritance and 2/3 by purchase. In the second part of the text, a neighboring plot is described. It measured about 460 square meters and was acquired by Imshishi's brother, Kadamu, by purchase. This plot again adjoined a plot of the youngest brother, Ludingira. Obviously, the whole area belonged to the Ninlilzingu family. In the third part of the text, it is stated that the dimensions and ownership of the plots were ascertained on behalf of the descendants of Imshishi and Kadamu. At the same time, the descendants of Imshishi divided their part of the plot, so it was probably they who initiated the ascertainment concerning the plot, which was owned jointly over more than 100 years. Where was the plot located? The house of the Ninlilzingu family was partially excavated 70 years ago. The area southwest of it was indeed unbuilt in the earlier levels. But from about 1800 onwards, houses were built in this area. So the jointly owned unbuilt plot was not here. Perhaps it lay on one side of the building which was not excavated. How common was joint heirship? Because it needed no documentation, an answer is not easy to find. Indirect evidence is provided by information on neighbors. Neighbors were mentioned to identify a certain plot when it was up for alienation. From Old Babylonian Nippur, about 400 relevant documents are known today. In these documents, there are nearly 200 attestations of single persons as neighbors. To give one example, there was a field adjacent to Lugalmelem, the singer. 18 times, group of two or three persons are mentioned as neighbors, for example, a house next to the plot of Damik Ilishu and Dingir Manshum. In 9 documents, the son of a person who was probably deceased are attested as neighbors, for example, a garden which was situated next to the garden of the sons of Sin Tayar. For the majority of groups of persons as neighbors, the relation between the group members remains unclear. Sometimes they were different filiations. Only in 3 cases can it be confirmed that the persons were brothers. So we are left with only 3 + 9 = 12 attestations which might attest joint heirship out of a total of more than 220 attestations of neighbors. That is about only 5%. This result shows that joint heirship was a possible strategy against the risks of inheritance division, but not a widely used one. Already during his lifetime, the father of a family had a possibility to avoid the division of certain assets. He could give them to an Aditu daughter who was consecrated to a god. In Nippur, as well as in Sippa, Naditus lived in a sort of cloister. They were not allowed to get married and have biological children. They could use and increase the property which was bestowed on them by their families by doing business. After the death of a Naditu, it fell back to her family. A good example can be found in the family of Endel Rabbi. His 4 sons divided his inheritance in the year 1800. It consisted of a 66 square meters house and a 5-hectare field. The heirs had a sister. She was consecrated as an aditum to the god Ninurta. 2 years earlier, she had received a gift from her father, who was still alive at that time, and her eldest brother. The gift consisted of a slave, silver and furniture, but also a huge field of 7.5 hectares. Let us act on the assumption that this was the whole estate of Endel Rabbi. He owned thus a field of about 12.5 hectares. His 4 sons shared the smaller part, 5 hectares, while the bigger part of 7.5 hectares remained undivided in the hands of his Naditu daughter. The family tree of Endel Rabbi shows that in his family a Naditum is attested in every generation. In the corpus of about 600 legal documents from old Babylonian Nippur, 70 Naditus with different filiations are attested. They occur as sellers or purchasers in 20% of the sale documents from this town. For Sippa, Martin Stoll put the number of attested Naditus at 700. That demonstrates that the consecration of Naditus was quite common and that these women had significant property at their disposal. So far, we have seen strategies to prevent the division of property before an inheritance division took place. During the execution of a division, however, it was also possible to preserve assets as a whole. An heir could inherit an asset undivided and compensate his co-heirs instead with payments in silver or with assets in the inheritance. Compensation payments in silver are frequently attested when an inheritance contained goods which were quite difficult to divide or of unequal value. If, for example, a deceased person owned only 1 chariot but had 2 sons, they did not dismantle the chariot so that each would get a stack of boards and wheels. Instead, 1 heir got the whole chariot and compensates his brother with silver. With regard to real estate, silver payments are only attested if 1 heir got a smaller share than the other, or a plot of minor quality. There are only 3 inheritance documents in which individual heirs did not get a share in a real estate but were compensated instead with other assets from the inheritance. 1 heir, for example, did not get a share in a field but a prebend instead. In the 2nd case, 1 did not get a share in a house but an extra field. The third document is comparable. 2 out of 4 heirs got field instead of house. Half of the roughly 50 well-preserved inheritance documents from Nippur contain compensation payments. If these payments were used to divide assets among some, not all of the heirs, only in 3 cases, then it was clearly not a very common practice. The rule was the inheritance division among all heirs in equal parts. However, we know of at least one prominent case where family property was kept together by compensation payments. Again, the dossier of Ninlesigu provides the evidence. This family owned several prebends. Over 7 generations and a period of 200 years, the eldest son got all, or at least the bigger part of the prebends and the subsistence field, in his extra share. He compensated his co-heirs with his share in large areas of farmland in the inheritance or with assets from his own possessions. Once an inheritance division was completed, there was still a chance to reunite divided plots in one hand. One heir could purchase the shares of his brothers. The 4 heirs of Erisum Matum provide an example of this practice. They divided a house of nearly 70 square meters. Each heir got an equal share, and the eldest brother got an extra share. In the following 1.5 months, the eldest brother bought the shares from his co-heirs one after the other. We do not know what happened further with the house. Maybe the eldest brother lived in it with his family. Other scenarios are also conceivable, as the following example shows. 4 sons of a deceased man named Ilum Nashi divided a house. Elizabeth Stone convincingly identified the divided house as the excavated house in which the documents were found. The area of 53 square meters was divided evenly between the heirs with an extra share for the eldest brother. Subsequently, 2 of the heirs acquired the shares of their brothers by purchase and exchange. One of these heirs sold his enlarged share afterwards to a neighbor. In the end, only one of the heirs still held a share of 23 square meters in the house. The neighbor, who does not seem to have belonged to the family, owned 30 square meters. While the first example seems to demonstrate that divided shares could be reunited by purchase, the second example serves as a warning. We do not necessarily know the intention behind this transaction. Was it to keep family property together within the family, or was it to sell it out of the family? I think it's likely that small plots were actually divided solely with the intent to sell them. The redistribution of inheritance by purchase was thus a strategy to deal with very small inheritance shares, but not necessarily to keep family property within the family. In conclusion, we have seen various methods with the potential to prevent a fragmentation of property caused by inheritance division. It seems, however, that to a large extent, these methods were only applied in individual cases or particularly families. An exception might be the consecration of naditus, but this practice was probably not motivated solely by economic considerations. The effects of the rather sporadic, non-systematic use of strategies to counteract the diminution of property can be seen in the wealthy family of Ninlesigu once more. The wealth of fields, blue in the diagram, was reduced in the first inheritance division in 1860 to 25% per family branch. This amount was then maintained over the next 100 years. the inheritance divisions in the years 1809 and 1737 do not apply to all heirs and mention only part of the whole inheritance. The impression that the property was diminished here is thus not true. But when we look at the house property, orange in the diagram, we can see it melt away over the years. A rich family like Ninesingus could compensate for these effects partly with profits from their remaining property, but less wealthy families are likely to have been hit much faster and harder by the fragmentation of their possessions caused by inheritance division. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.